So yeah, I'd like to acknowledge Peter. Thank you for making the effort to be with us this weekend, and I know you've been very busy working tirelessly for the election of the candidate in Wentworth, and congratulations on the outcome. It's been a joy getting to know you more deeply this weekend, and I really like to thank you for your modelling or an expression of vulnerability yesterday during our interview. And I knew that wasn't necessarily an easy thing for you to do. So. I've also appreciated how what a strong sense of history you have, since I've gotten to know you better. I mean, me and Peter have been talking we've known each other for a long time, but we haven't been close friends. And we've been speaking a lot on the phone over the past few years, but Peter has an incredible, both a sense of local history, with his grandparents having lived in Bellingen, but also just his sense of history in all different aspects of life in Australia. In fact, you were very moved going into the Bellingen Township yesterday afternoon. Now, that was the first time since the 90s or something you've been into Bellingen. Yeah. So Peter's family has a connection with the town. And thank you all again. It always amazes me to be, just for so many people to show up and to really engage with some really serious questions about life, but also hopefully to enjoy yourselves as well and appreciate all the kind of intimacy that we experience even without speaking to each other, just knowing that we're all on a shared journey together. I wasn't sure what to talk about this afternoon, but what I've done is basically just taken about four questions came up today. So there was one question in the morning from Phil about goals in practice. There was the questions from Zaid and Chelsea about, does it matter what school or teacher or practice? And also, I guess, the question from Suzanne about conflict between Christianity and Zen Buddhism. And there may be some other questions that come up as we are talking, but there were some really good questions, and found both Peter's talk very stimulating and the questions very stimulating. Me and Peter don't necessarily see eye to eye in every aspect of Zen practice, but this is something we all need to become acquainted with in the land of Buddhisms. As I've mentioned often now, it's a lot of diversity, and there's no one authority in Buddhism, which is a good thing. There's no text you can go back to point out that's the truth. And there's no one teacher who speaks the truth. And a good healthy skepticism is part of Buddhist practice, to question everything. One of the things about I think that kind of expression of Buddhism is an expression of the impermanence of everything, including Buddhist teachings, and how they have to continuously reinvent themselves all the time. And of course, one of the difficulties of that is that without there being a necessarily an acknowledged canon, you know, an acknowledged core of what the teachings are, well, who knows what Buddhism is? You know, it's an ongoing debate. And which is, again, not necessarily a bad thing, and very much one of the reasons, I think, why Buddhism as a practice, as a way of living, as a religion, as a philosophy, the different interpretations of how you want to view it, is so relevant to our postmodern times, where a lot of these certainties and truths are up for grabs. But I do believe that we do have to have some sense of some kind of trust in some traditions, even though they may not have the total truth. For example, science doesn't have the truth, but it has a methodology for falsifying statements. So it has a built-in questioning built into it through its experimental method. And it's a kind of knowledge which doesn't necessarily belong to one person. There's, you know, science is a public knowledge. It's something which we can all test out for ourselves. And truth in science is something which is arrived at by consensus. And truth being agreement on facts, for example, and which facts disprove which theories. So science doesn't have the truth, but in many ways it's very pragmatic. Science can make things work. It can send a person to the moon. It's a pretty amazing thing. So in many ways, Buddhism has many similarities to science in that way. It doesn't have the truth, and hopefully doesn't claim to have the truth.
But if you read those teachings that have come down to us, the claim is that it does have some pragmatic value. It does have something which works.
And the historical Buddha, remember the earliest perhaps written texts we have were about 400 years after the verbal teachings. But in these verbal teachings, the emphasis over and over again is on suffering and the ending of suffering. He doesn't really worry too much about the higher metaphysical questions, such as is there a God or isn't there a God? Is there an afterlife or not? These are not important questions to the historical Buddha. And he was much more concerned with right now. What can we do right now to relieve the pain and the suffering that we are experiencing to create a better world? In answer to the question about what does it matter about what school or which teacher or what practice? My answer to that is both yes and no. No, it doesn't really matter in the sense that which, you know, all human beings are of equal value. You know, we're all naked without our clothing, and it really doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian or an atheist. It doesn't really matter. Then in terms of the sincere questioning, what really matters to you, what really matters to me? That's to ask those questions to yourself, to really be authentic about that. And if we all ask those questions, and you know, maybe we come up with an answer, something along the lines of, well, I think it's important to be a good person and to do no harm. And so you'll find those values in most religions and most philosophies, whether it's humanism, Christianity, Islam, etc. But then, of course, we look at the history of humanity, and we sometimes have to question, how come if this is teachings all about love or being a good person, why is there still so much violence in the world in the name of religion or in the name of ideology and so on? So again, we go to, we search that question. So it might be really important to be a good person. It might not be important to be a good person. We might say to ourselves, well, nothing really matters. That sense of nihilism, I'll just do whatever I want and just enjoy myself. But like we say in the, when we chant or recite the four practice principles, we talk about life as being the teacher. And the same way in which Peter was talking about the reality of cause and effect. No one escapes cause and effect. At some point we find ourselves at a certain place in our lives and we start to ask these questions again. You know, what's my life about? What is a good life? How do I lead a good life? These are just our own personal questions that come up. And it makes sense that we talk to other people about it or we read books about it in that quest. And not only do we read books or talk to people, but we get to know people as well. We enter into relationships with people. And we give our trust to people. And we sometimes allow ourselves to be mentored by somebody. This is a huge trust that is given. Unfortunately, in spiritual teachings and religious practices, sometimes that trust has been awfully betrayed, as we all know. And then we ask those questions again, they come up. And so we're always on this quest to try and figure out what our lives are about. And whether we have children or don't have children doesn't really matter, but when we do have children, sometimes that comes up as even as a more keen question. What's my life about? What can I provide for this child that's just miraculously being born? It was after my son was born, was when I started sitting Zen practice. I moved away from reading books about it and started sitting because I wanted to try and create a family environment that he could grow up in, and it would be a healthy and loving environment. But unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. To the best of my ability, the marriage still collapsed in a very devastating way. And he was hurt in that process, as we all were. But, you know, we pick ourselves up and we start again. So it's I don't think those questions, but those questions are the big questions, and every human being is asked those questions, and there's a whole, you know, library of books you could go through, but we haven't got multiple, you know, lives. As far as I'm concerned, I'm agnostic about afterlife, and I don't think it's that important. Our time is limited, and as our lives go by, obviously we become more and more aware of that. So at some time, at some point, we kind of have to kind of make some kind of commitment, take some kind of risk. So when we enter into a relationship, a marriage or a partnership with somebody, when we give ourselves fully to love somebody, we know that we're always taking a risk when we do that. But it's worthwhile doing that. It's better to take that risk than to be alone. Some people may thrive as a hermit, but not many of us. Most of us prefer to be with a partner and within a group. That's the general wiring of human beings. So I think the commitment to, certainly when a philosophy becomes a practice, it requires some sense of taking a risk and taking a commitment and seeing if it works. And you have to give it a chance. And you have to throw yourself into it with your heart as well as your mind. That's that's why it matters as to what tradition or what teacher you practice with. And it's perfectly fine to do some shopping around. Everybody does that. Even in the classical Chinese Zen tradition, it was very, very common for to study with one teacher, and then you would be encouraged to go off and meet with other teachers and entertain some kind of dialogue with other teachers and to sharpen your understanding and your practice. It's really, we can really reduce all these issues down to two things: the sameness and difference, equality and differentiation, and we need them both. You know, we all have equal value as human beings. Everyone should be treated equally at the same level of worth. And we also need to respect individual differences. We're always trying to find the balance in that way. And in the same way that you're not going to necessarily marry the first person you meet and have go out on a date with, you're not necessarily going to make a commitment to one particular teacher or tradition like in that way. You have to, through your own experience, like your personal experience of the tradition, of the teacher, you will be attracted in the same way as we're attracted, like, in my profession of psychotherapy, the personal relationship is very, very important. And it's like any other relationship. And we're not necessarily going to click with every person. It's very much the same in a spiritual relationship or a teacher-student relationship. You get drawn to someone you feel there's some kind of fit with, and then you get to experience that person. You get to experience their integrity. It wasn't until really I started. I've been sitting Zen for quite a while. It wasn't until I moved to Northern Queensland for a year and was quite isolated, and I started an email correspondence with Barry Majid, and it was from that email correspondence that our relationship developed. So I don't even got to see him face to face very often, but even in that email correspondence, like I did mention this to Peter the other day, the defining quality that always remained with me about Barry and still does today was his generosity. It was his generosity of time. I'm feeling quite emotional. It was his ability to give of himself. I knew he was a very, very busy person. And, coming from a working class Manchester boy background, having missed out on grammar school and thinking I was pretty, not that smart. It took me a lot of years in my life to actually get the courage to talk to people in that way, to think of myself as being of equal worth. And these are these cultural conditionings and societal factors, family of origin factors, affect us. And it was in my teacher's willingness to be there for me, that made the difference. There are other factors as well. He's very philosophical. He's well educated, and that's something I've always been attracted to. But sometimes I think he could go on a bit too much philosophically as well. Sometimes I prefer things to be kept really simple. So to me it was more about the authenticity and genuineness of his character that made all the difference. And I thought, well, if that practice has got something to do with how that person is, then it's a worthwhile practice. Never before in the history of humanity have we had so much available to us on the internet, so many teachers and teachings, some smorgasbord. But how do you really get to know somebody, even in those situations? How do you get to trust them? You don't necessarily have to. Obviously, Barry's in New York, I'm in Australia, we don't see each other very often. But you can still appreciate someone's character. And there are ways we have of, you know, we can see. So I would just encourage you to think of practice as practice. You know, it's not that much different from getting better at learning the piano or guitar or whatever it is we're practicing. The more we practice, the better we get. But also the importance of relationship, to have a relationship both with a teacher and with a what in Buddhism is called Sangha, which I'm happy just to call a community of good friends, you know, who come together. When Barry gave me this little green thing, which signified him giving me permission to teach, it really is a form of entrustment. He entrusted me with his teaching. He trusted me enough to encourage me to teach. And so I want to honor that entrustment. And aspire to the same level of generosity. So, in terms of the question about goals in practice, as I mentioned to Peter the other day, we were talking about it, and I think I mentioned it yesterday as well, there's a lovely, lovely quote from Shunryu Suzuki, the Japanese teacher went to San Francisco in the 60s, who wrote the book called A Beginner's Mind. And at some place in his, I'm not quite sure which book it's in, but he says, you are perfect as you are, and you could do with a little improvement. And that's kind of like a koan. It's a really beautiful sort of captures that sort of paradox that we're all engaged in. To accept the perfection not only of ourselves, but of our partners, our friends, and everyone else. And at the same time, we could all do with a little improvement, couldn't we? You know, we could all be a little bit more generous, or we could all be a little bit more wiser, or you know, whatever it might be. You know, we could maybe sit a bit longer, or we, you know, there's so many ways in which we could work on ourselves. But we work on ourselves, in a sense, to try not to get caught into what Barry talks about, the self-improvement project. It's not about changing because we perceive ourselves as being deficient or somehow lacking or not good enough. The aspiration of practice is more about becoming more truly who we are already, and also joining in that awakening process. To awakening has to be a culture of awakening. It just can't be about me. I wouldn't exist without my mother and father, not just in the sense of being born, but I wouldn't have a self without my mother, right? If I'd just been put into an orphanage and left in a bed for 3 years, I wouldn't have a self, not the kind of self I have now. Myself wouldn't have grown. So we're all dependent upon relationship, you know. We can't do this on our own. We have to do it with each other. We have to create the kind of culture here now, locally, in our community, in our little Sangha or community here, in our friendships, the kind of culture we want the world to be about. So one of the things, I guess, in Zen, in terms of a goal, it's more about an aspiration, it's more about the perfection of character. And so the sense in which we, in Zen Buddhism, there's these six things called the six paramitas, or the six perfections, or sometimes known as the word paramita sometimes is getting to the other shore. I mean, in terms of a tradition too, that's a nice metaphor that's often used in Buddhism, that the practice is kind of like the raft which takes you to the other shore. The other shore being nirvana, but remember, nirvana is also here and now. Nirvana is when we're able to respond to each other and ourselves from a place of non-reactivity, where we can respond with compassion and wisdom. Our practice is like this raft which can take us there. But what I mean, when we get to the other side of the shore, then maybe the practice has become, or the raft has become so much a part of ourselves that we can swim without the raft. But like Peter says, we then sit because we just, sitting's what we do. It's just become part of our life. The same as brushing our teeth, the same as speaking respectfully, speaking with possibility, speaking with, speaking in a way which wants to help to awaken us all up. This all becomes part of who we are. So in Buddhism we talk about the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And the Buddha is the teacher, the Dharma is the practice, or the teachings, and the Sangha is this little group here, the community. And every Sangha is part of a larger community, obviously, and then globally. And I think it's okay for this diversity to have lots and lots of little networks, little communities. Because as we all know, when an organization gets to be very large, I mean, we are wired to being, as human beings, to being in small groups. If I had a sangha of 1,000 people, that might be good for my ego, but it would be really hard for me to have a close, intimate relationship with everybody. So, and Barry's sangha in New York, he's a brilliant teacher, but it averages around about maybe 20 that will come along on his Saturdays when he gives his talk and so on. Sometimes we get about maybe 30 at a session. New York's a big place, and he doesn't have any ambitions about, having to have 1,000 students. He's quite happy just to have a small group and enjoy that. And again, that's intimacy, and we create this together, Rennie's not here today, but as I was talking to Peter about how this particular community, this Sangha, not just about me creating it, we're all creating it, we're all adapting and developing. And as I said before, hopefully we don't lose the baby in the bathwater, whatever the baby is. But maybe the baby is the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, I don't know. But we adapt it to our needs, to our Australian Zen practice. What is Australian Zen practice? What is the practice in this, mid-north coast? What shape does that take? And it gets shaped. We shape it. We shape it for a way. We want it to work for us. And so I'm very open to people sharing ideas with me and evolving and creating as we go. Now, in some ways, is it possible we've got to the point of evolution where we can somehow consciously make a difference in our evolution now? As a species on this planet, we've inherited this particular brain that we have, and as we know, it's very highly wired towards survival, and that can all sometimes lead to territorial wars, but it's also highly wired towards affiliation and attachment. Hence, the basis for compassion is already built into our biological system. Can we consciously move more towards affiliation and compassion and away more from this territorial conflict over possessions? Can we consciously affect our evolution? Maybe. Maybe there's a hope. Maybe it's too late. But we have to act as if there is a hope, I think. finally, the question, Suzanne, about, I wasn't quite sure what your question was about the conflict between Christianity and Buddhism. But if you reduce it to this whole question about what's a good life and how to be a good person, where's the conflict? Is there any conflict there?
It's just the indoctrination of that.
Right.
Yeah, it's been very strong. I just feel like, I don't know, it's just what's very strong, and it's very hard for me to leave it behind.
Right. But you're aware of it.
Yeah, I'm very much aware of it.
Yeah.
It took me a long time, though. Yeah.
So where's the conflict then?
Well, because I'm always at war with not going there or coming here. Because it's
not
at the same time.
Sorry.
I've got a Sunday morning. It's very
Sunday morning, yeah.
Church services are on.
Yeah.
And then Zen Buddhism.
Yeah.
Practices on Sunday morning at the same time. So yeah. I have to make a decision when I'm going
to
go.
Okay. Well, that's a nice decision to have to make. I think the Anglican priest in Bellingen does need some support. I heard she only got 6 or 7 people here a week.
I've been there 3 times.
Okay.
It was children screaming all the time. I just couldn't. I just wasn't brought up to that. And, you know, I was very indoctrinated in the church, I heard. Yeah, very much.
You know, again, I think it comes down to these sort of trusting, you know, being able to trust yourself as to what's most beneficial for you and the rest of your life as to where you want to commit your time. Okay. So it's at 3:15. So open to questions, comments. Anybody wants to share something?
Sunday and on a Sunday, I think there's still another 6 days to look at everything else, and I might not be able to make it to some of these things because I've worked away and do things, but I will be trying my darndest to practice as much as I can on all different forms of anything really. I mean, I do martial arts and I do this and I want to try a few other things, and that's just how it's going to be, but I'm not afraid of that because they're not against each other, these ones that I feel like this. There is no attack on another religion through Buddhism or through Roman Zen. I have found no conflict between the two because I think it doesn't ask for conflict. It doesn't. It works in harmony, I think, as well.
That's beautiful.
Timing, that's very coincidental.
Yeah, that's lovely, Mitch. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really beautiful. Yeah.
No coincidence.
Yeah. Thank you for coming these last two, yesterday and today.
Thank you for having me, everybody. Yeah.
And Zay, thank you for bringing him.
Yeah.
Have you been going, Zay?
Good. I did have one question. I was wondering whether, I guess, this branch of Buddhism, Zen, I guess I'm still new to it, so I'm still starting to understand it. Wonder whether it's from my observation, seems to be a little more philosophy-based than practical-based, I guess I'm comparing it to Vipassana, where it's observation of your senses. The philosophy is quite minimal.
Yeah, it's a great question. In this branch, like in terms of what they call lineage, like your family tree, so my teacher and his teacher, right? So like my. You know, it's like we often say in the Dharma, like Barry's my father in the Dharma and Joker's my grandmother in the Dharma. So in terms of my father and my grandmother, then there's a lot of emphasis, more by Joker, but still by Barry, in terms of direct experiencing of the body. She saw that as being core practice and a very, very healing practice. She wasn't as philosophical as Barry. So, Barry can get a bit more philosophical. But that's something I quite like a lot of the time. So, yeah. So maybe a bit more philosophy with Barry than with Joker. Yeah. That's not everybody's cup of tea, but you've got to be who you are, right? You know?
Yeah. It's good to explore all the different things.
Yeah. Sure, go. Cool.
Just how did you find?
I guess the practice was really simple. It was easy to follow. And it sort of fit really well with me because I guess I'm a feeling intuitive person rather than an intellectually puzzle based line sort of practice. I just felt like it was really beneficial, but I also had a lot more time to practice that. So I guess if I had the same amount of time to practice this technique, it might unfold differently.
I'd like to say something, Andrew. I've said this to you before, it always amazes me how points come up, you know, within these days that we do this that just directly relate to my recent experience, and I love the synchronicity of that. Because one of the one thing I have been struggling with a bit lately has been a kind of a sense of isolation within myself. You know, having this aspiration towards this, creating a more, working with the Dharma and working towards better practice, but feeling disconnected from that body, that community.
Mm-hmm.
And also just in my own personal life, I just recently, you know, you're getting older, you're experiencing a sense of mortality, and also you're experiencing that sense of the isness of you. It's a very singular thing, and it is, in a sense, what it comes down to. You know, we come into this world alone, we leave this world alone. We are it's this dichotomy, you know, while we're here, we need to be connected to something. But at the end, it's just going to come down to your own sort of isolation in a sense, that this sense of this is just my experience, no one else will have this. And so I just found it great how you were connecting up the fact that within a practice which at times can be a lonely place to be, because it's not where everybody's at. You know, you can't talk to all your friends about what you do on this level. So it's just reinforced for me how important it is to connect to, you know, this sort of brotherhood, really, this community.
And sisterhood.
And sisterhood, of course, sorry. Yeah, so I just want to...
Or maybe just be personhood, maybe, I don't know.
Sorry?
Personhood?
Yeah, that'll work.
Okay. Peter talked about that very thing on his talk on Friday night.
Did you?
Yeah, Peter did, with the about coming into the world alone and leaving alone, didn't you?
Yeah.
You spoke about that on Friday night.
Yeah.
I think you called it individuation.
Yes, exactly.
But even if, for example, you know, you're lying on your deathbed and you're all on your all by yourself, I think for most of us, we'd probably like to have someone with us, holding our hand. Maybe.
Yeah.
But like, if we were on our own, even at that point, we're always in relationship. There might not be a relationship to a human being, but
yeah,
there might be a bird.
Yeah,
singing out the window.
Yeah, and I think that's what I connected with today, you know, especially just the sense that the interconnections are always there, that you are supported. And you know, doing this this work, moving on this journey, can be quite difficult, and sometimes you just do feel quite isolated.
I agree. I agree. I mean, there is,
you know, when the meaning, the context drops away from things in your life that used to be important, but now all of a sudden the layer has peeled, and it can leave you with a sense of isolation.
Yeah, I mean, I think Vipassana is a great practice, and there are all different kinds of, you know, Vipassana teachings, whether you're Burmese Vipassana or Indian Vipassana, whatever the Vipassana might be. But some of the, like, for example, sometimes I felt that for me personally, like, some of the Vipassana practice was too isolating for me.
Mm.
And I found, paradoxically, Zen can be like that too. Like, if you went on a session in Japan, you're just facing a wall, and maybe, you know, that feels very isolating as well. I think what a lot of the female teachers brought, like Joker and Tony Packer and others, was this emphasis on sharing and community. And Barry's continued the importance of that, the importance of relationship, the importance of attachment. This practice is not about not being non-attached to anything, not certainly not to friends. It's about not being attached to our anger and our fear, but it's certainly about being attached to people we love and care for. And just embracing that, you know, embracing the emotions which go with that when we lose somebody. It's about becoming more fully human. It's not about not being human, it's about the full potential of being human.
And I think sitting with a group is really, really powerful. And I think the effects are sometimes not necessarily noticeable at the time, even though you feel good at the time, but a bit later on, you actually have a reaction to something or an engagement with something that you would never have thought. I went home yesterday and I caught a spider and put it outside. I don't like spiders. I've never done that. And my daughter went to the bath, so I caught this daddy long legs, which I would have normally just gone to the vacuum cleaner without a thought. Come on, Spidey, do it, lock it. Out you go. Go outside, come back inside. My husband goes, what are you doing? I just let a spider outside. And he just went, you? A spider? I'm like, yeah, just put a spider outside. It was just such an unlikely thing for me to do, but it just was such second nature at that time to look at this spider as something more than just a spider.
Beautiful.
Mm. That's great.
Would you like to come back to our place tonight?
Daddy long legs, I'm starting small.
The spider gatherer. You can maybe even make a job out of it. Like those mouse traps that you don't.
I just want to say I really enjoyed reading Leave Yourself Alone. I couldn't help but laugh.
Yeah, I heard you laughing. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, Barry does have a good sense of humour. Anyone else? Any final comments or questions?
Is there a chance we could get some copies of those readings, or maybe even others try down the name of them?
Most of the readings are on my website.
Yeah, of course.
Andrew, thank you. I really appreciated, like, all you offered, and particularly moved feeling Barry. It felt like Barry came alive for me.
Mm.
I hadn't felt him before.
Mm.
It's really moving.
Thank you. You'll be pleased. Mm. Okay, we'll break for afternoon tea. Thank you.